Well, I can see that Indians is a subject that has been of interest to you, and I'm glad to see that so many of you have come to consider this, which is both historically fascinating in and of itself, as well as important to us as we think about missions in New England, because I think missions in New England remain to this day a unique endeavor. People who come from other places expecting churches to be planted quickly or easily are always disappointed, and so because they underestimate the daunting task, which in very many ways is quite similar, and we'll see that at the end of our lecture, to the kind of situation that our forefathers many centuries ago encountered as they came to these shores. I remember in grade school back in the 50s being presented with this lovely picture of the Indians gathering for this great feast and having Squanto among several other Indians come and help, and they had been those that had helped to teach them how to plant the maize, the corn that they were able to harvest and feed themselves with, and that was a lovely picture. But I realized from reading a lot more history since then that it was much too sanitized. There was a lot more going on in that period than we were aware of back in the sixth grade. And then on the other hand, we've gone to the other extreme by picturing the Indians as the noble savage and the Europeans as the nasty bad guys who came and stole land and brought disease. And while there is some truth to that, it's certainly not true overall of the Puritans and Pilgrims that came here in 1620 and inhabited the land through King Philip's War in 1675. And it is just that narrow period that I want to look at now in some detail as we think about what they actually did, and then think about how that might be of instruction to us as we think about what we are as Christians, as witnesses here in the modern world in New England. The Puritan relationship with the Indians is a model in many ways, and even though I don't share their view of a Christian nation, a Christian commonwealth, I think that the wisdom that they brought to their enterprise should be of great help to us. And one thing to clear up right at the outset, and I was heartened to see this in reading what I think is a secular author, a journalist, who's been exploring what went on in all of the North American area prior to Columbus. And he focuses in several chapters on New England. And he reminds us that Indians is still the right name to call the original inhabitants that had been here for a few centuries before we arrived. And it's the right name because, guess what? This is what they like to call themselves, despite the fact that it is a historical misnomer because we thought we'd landed in India. And, of course, we didn't. But that's the name that stuck for centuries. And most of those people, in fact, all of them, according to Mann, who wrote back in 2005, like to be called Indians and not Native Americans, because they realize the folly of that term too. Anyone born here is obviously a native, and so they like that distinctive name of Indians. I think if I were of that blood, I would feel just the same way. Now, just briefly to cover some of the contacts, and I am only going to skim over this material. Books have been written on the early encounters, and there are several books. If you look at that bibliography, I've picked the choicest for reading in this area. But the pre-Mayflower encounters between 1000 and 1620 would include the Vikings. And we don't know much of what went on between 1000 A.D. And when Columbus came. But we know that shortly after that, a Portuguese named Gaspar Corte Real came and did a wonderful thing for the Indians on the main coast. He abducted 50 of them, and so thus began a very bad feeling among the Indians, a justified bad feeling towards those who came to fish and to and to trade. And what was interesting, and here I haven't explored the implications of this, but he found that they were wearing and possessed items from Venice, Italy. And so the interconnections there are far more numerous than we have a record of at this time. The first written description was by a man who has a bridge named after him in New York named Verrazano, 1523. He said that the coastline from the Carolinas all the way to Narragansett Bay in Rhode Island was densely populated, which is very interesting because that's not what we found when we came here in 1620. The inhabitants of New England, especially because of its proximity to the east, were called, and I always love this name, it's such a poetic name, Dawnland people, or people of the first light. Isn't it such an interesting metaphor in terms of biblical truth? Even though they had no idea of the light of the gospel at the time, but that's what they named themselves, and that's what they were often referred to, even by the Puritans and others like Verrazano, who came back in the 16th century. And so it is also interesting at that time that we have accounts of the Indians' view of Europeans as being a small, weak, and ugly people with stubble all over their faces. So we normally, I think of ourselves as being the clean ones in that encounter, but that's not the way that they viewed it at all. And apparently we were also smelly. They were astonished that we would take linen handkerchiefs, the finest material, blow our noses, and then put it back into our pockets as if it were something precious. That's the sort of thing that I never heard of when I was in sixth grade. But these are part of the encounters and the record of those encounters that have been left for us to enjoy and learn from. 1602, Bartholomew Gosnold, a veteran of the failure of the Roanoke colony, returned in his ship, the Concord, laden with American merchandise. And so he had come to New England and taken copper pipes, tobacco, deerskins, furs, turtles, and hemp back to England. And so the idea that this was a rich resource and natural resources were abundant here was, in fact, quite true, and Gosnold reminded the English of that. And so thus is the motive begins to be enhanced by this kind of publicity that there are riches there to be had. And this is not a new motive going all the way back to the Spanish and their conquests in other parts of the Americas, but it was one that was clearly there and with good reason. There were indeed natural resources in abundance here. In 1603, a gentleman named Martin Pring brought 44 men for 7 weeks in order to harvest sassafras. It was believed to have medicinal benefits right there in Pawtuxet. You know where that is, right? It's Plymouth, Massachusetts. And so they came to that place where there was a natural, safe port. But the Indians made it very clear that they did not want them to stay. And so they left after 7 weeks. And that was pretty much the way that it went. Samuel Champlain, 1605-6, came and visited Cape Cod, but he left. And then in 1606, something changed. The London and Plymouth companies were chartered. And up to that point, only fishing, trading, and a little kidnapping had taken place. But these companies determined to settle in New England. And that's precisely what eventually happened. We also learn a very interesting encounter in 1605, just a year earlier. Captain George Weymouth docks in Plymouth, England, with a surprise cargo. He has five Indians, and it was like a circus, a sideshow, because there were these unusually dressed people. A very noble stature, by the way. They were muscular, tall, and very handsome. And so people from all over England knew that there was another population of people there in New England. And this was a huge source of publicity and a real turning point. And so that London and Plymouth companies made plans to go there and to stay. In 1606, Captain Raleigh Gilbert on the ship called the Mary and John along with Captain George Popham on another ship called the Gift of God, landed at the mouth of the Sagadahoc River in Maine under the auspices of Sir Fernando Gorges. There is a Civil War fort there in Portland Harbor in Casco Bay that is called Fort Gorges after this early entrepreneur and supporter of coming to New England. And this was very significant because they sought to stay. The problem is that because they were attacked by Indians, they ended up having to leave in 1608. And then finally, in 1614, Captain John Smith landed again at Patuxet. He begins to make maps of the area, which are very interesting, and he was a good map maker, and he names Patuxet Plymouth after Plymouth, England. And his lieutenant, however, Thomas Hunt, unknown to Smith, was off on another little journey, and he ends up doing something really awful that was a stench in the nostrils of the Indians, even when our forefathers, the Pilgrims, landed. He went and he kidnapped something over 24 Indians, one of which was Squanto, a very famous Indian who was a great help to the Pilgrims and the Puritans. And Squanto's name was actually Tisquantum, and he was taken off with others. Unfortunately, when some tried to escape, he ended up shooting a number of them and killing them. And so the Indians were very suspicious of the trustworthiness of the English. And so in 1620, our forefathers, the Pilgrims, came to Patuxet, to Cape Cod, and eventually ended up there at Plymouth, and they landed. Only what they found was not what Squanto had left, because he was actually a native. His people, his tribe, his village was Patuxet. It was Plymouth. And when he got back there, eventually in the early 1620s, there was nothing there. It was absolutely empty of all of his people. They had been utterly leveled by a plague. Many blame this on European contact, and that may well be true. We really don't fully know what it was, but we know that between 1616 and 1618 that the plagues wiped out whole villages, and there was nothing but skeletons left. It was truly horrible. It was like the Black Plague in medieval Europe. It may have been viral hepatitis A, but some say as much as 90% of the Indian population of New England was wiped out. Others say more like a third, but there was a tremendous loss, so that the number of Indians that were there in 1600 was many manifoldly greater than those that were there by the time the Pilgrims landed. One writer actually says that when the Pilgrims landed, it was like landing in a mass graveyard. And in fact, we ended up taking and settling in these empty village sites. Something like 50 towns in early New England were settled on these particular sites. Now also, something that especially meant to sort of undermine the simplistic ways in which New England and this early emigration was described, it was complex, and to show you something of the complexity, the great variety of tribes that were there is really overwhelming. Now, they were all part of the Abenaki Indians and those who spoke the Algonquin language, and there were different dialects of that. But there were many different tribes, and within them were sub-tribes, and so it was highly complicated. And they didn't have any common system of law or justice. They had an authority structure. They were in constant conflict one with another prior to the coming of the Pilgrims as well as afterward. The Mi'kmaqs were up in the Maritimes. The Passamaquoddy were in northern Maine. The Norridgewock were in central Maine. The Penobscot in central Maine. The Pigwackets in northern New Hampshire and southwestern Maine. The Penacook, there's a street right up here named Penacook, and then Penacook, New Hampshire, is up north of Concord. We're in central and southern New Hampshire. The Missisquoi were in northwestern Vermont. The Cowasuck, interesting, the word cow is in that, were northeastern and central Vermont. And then the Sakaki in southern Vermont. The Nipmucks were in central and western Mass. The Wampanoags, which would have been encountered by the Pilgrims initially in southeastern Mass and Cape Cod. The Narragansett in Rhode Island. And the Mohegan and Pequot in Connecticut. It's almost exhausting to read those, but just to give you a sense of the tremendous complexity of the situation into which the Pilgrims came. Also, Squanto is usually painted as a hero, and we don't know. He may have truly become a Christian. He was certainly exposed to the gospel very clearly, and in many instances, he was in England about 5 years before he returned here, and so he learned English culture. But he was a bit of a tricky fellow, and he sort of played the Indians at home against the English for his own ends. On his deathbed, however, he did ask prayer to go to be in the heaven of the God of the Pilgrims. And so perhaps someday we will meet him there. But again, a good reminder as you read about his life that it was not as simple as the popular myths often want to portray them. The first chief, a chief who was the chief sachem or sachem of the Wampanoags, was the first one to encounter the Pilgrims when they landed in 1620. Actually, it wasn't until the next year after they landed, and they would have encountered him as a chief of an alliance that included the Nausets on Cape Cod, the Massachusetts, where the state name comes from, which would have been sort of around Boston Harbor. And so the whole of southeastern Mass was in this triple tribe alliance when our forefathers came. To remind you of the tragedy of the plagues, his people were reduced from about 20,000 in the broad population, 2,000 for his immediate tribe, to about 1,000 total with about 60 left. So it was more than 90% of his tribe were decimated by the plague that took over New England just before the Pilgrims arrived. But the good thing in God's providence was that when they arrived, the Indians, especially Massasoit, was in a great mood to have an alliance with the Pilgrims so that they could help protect him now in his reduced situation against the other tribes that were very hostile to them, particularly the Narragansetts and the Pequots. There are a number of myths as you come, you know, you get this picture. Also part of the mythology is that we were very sophisticated. We had muskets and we dressed like gentlemen and ladies, and these primitive Indians were very primitive in their technology. And yet, as we encountered them, a number of things should be noticed. First of all, the Pilgrims were totally unprepared to come here to begin with, and to come and spend a winter here, they were utterly unprepared for, and they showed themselves to be quite foolish in this regard. But the other thing that they didn't reckon on is that their muskets were less accurate and could not shoot as far as the Indian arrows. And their archers were highly skilled as warriors. Also, their maize was a very high-yielding corn. And if it hadn't been for that, they never would have survived that first winter or the second winter and beyond. Also, their moccasins were comfortable and waterproof. The boots of the English were not comfortable and not nearly as waterproof. And then finally, the birch bark canoes were much faster and more maneuverable than the ships and the boats, particularly the small boats for getting around the coastland, were of the English. And so lots of myths rethink, because many of them are not true. Now, another thing that has been misunderstood sort of from the other side of the mythology, that is from the politically correct side of the mythology, is the instability of native populations. We're often told that they didn't understand land ownership, they were sort of this noble savage that really, you know, ownership wasn't very important to them. That's partly true because the sachems had an eye for their goods. And so if you owned too much, the sachems would take it, sort of like what the federal government at its worst tends to be like. And so the Indians are pictured as roaming around New England as nomads. In fact, really the only ones that were great hunters and that tended to move their dwellings a lot were north of the Kennebec River in Maine. And in the southern parts where the crop season was longer, villages stayed where they were and people didn't roam. They had homes and they knew the boundaries of their land. And furthermore, they owned property and they knew that they owned property. They passed it on from one generation to another. And in fact, in many cases where they were up against the New York border, Western Mass and Connecticut and Vermont, against dangerous Indian enemies, they had fortified towns in order to protect themselves. Now, when it comes to Indian religion, probably there, what you suspect is exactly the way it was. They were really animists. They believed, as so many unbelievers in the ancient world did, that the powers of nature were gods, whether it was sun or rain or fertility. One person said that in a particular part of the Narragansett tribe, there were 38 different gods that were identifiable. And so they were polytheists, and as well as being anthropomorphic. They were very much man-centered in their view of religion. They didn't really have a very defined theology. They had no written documents, and so they didn't read. They didn't pass on traditions in a written form that would be very exact, but rather they did so orally. So all of that is a background then to what it was like. Imagine this place, which was once a thriving Indian population with lots of complicated politics, primitive in some ways as far as law and organization, and yet quite agile in terms of living off the land and having a nice little rural life in their villages, but now decimated by this plague, like a graveyard, a people that were truly depressed. And along comes this ship called the Mayflower, with people that really didn't know how to survive the winter. They lost more than 50% of the pilgrims that came on that ship died in that first winter, many of them dying on the ship itself because they had no food and they were very poorly equipped to deal with what in New England is often a very brutal, brutal season. And so the Nossets and the Wampanoags right there, because of the killings of Thomas Hunt, they were not real excited about Europeans coming. Little did they know that they were observing, when they observed the pilgrims from their hillsides, watching them carefully, watching every movement, that these were people that meant them good, that actually wanted to treat them fairly, justly, and even had their eternal welfare at stake. And yet they didn't realize this, and so they watched with great care. The first contact actually came in December, and the pilgrims fortunately had their guns, and there were enough of them. They had surrounded themselves in a kind of fortification there on the beach, and they were able to resist the Indians, scaring them off without anyone dying in the process. And then they also found what were called corn barns, and these would have been mounds that were covered to hide them of maize, and it was those that they took. They didn't know where they came from, but they used those to survive. And of course, now that's the beginning of the mythology that they stole from the Indians. In fact, they went out of their way later on, not long after, when they began to prosper a bit, to replace all of that maize because they had a very strong view about the sin of stealing. And also, something driven by their theology, the theology of the Bible, which they believed to be the infallible Word of God, they believed that these Indians were not in any sense racially inferior. They were religiously inferior because they didn't have the gospel. But they believed that these were people made in the image of God, to be treated with tremendous respect. And that's precisely what they endeavored to do as they encountered these Indians, even though they were afraid of them to some degree because they knew that they could be violent if provoked. And so their attitude was one in which they really had a concern, and some of them even believed, oddly enough, that they had come originally from the 10 lost tribes of Israel. And so they had this sort of odd theology, which we would today attribute to cults, but they believed that somehow they were related to the original Old Covenant people, and that would add a reason for treating them with tremendous respect. Now, it is true, and many will quote several of the early pilgrims, the Bradford statements particularly, that indeed God made a way for us through the plagues. He opened a way so that we could come here and there would be room for us because he had depopulated the Indians. But that's not at all to say that they didn't have compassion for them or thought that that was a wonderful thing, but they were simply recognizing that indeed the Lord had opened up a way so that they could settle there. And I think that that particular quote from Bradford is often very much exaggerated out of prejudice against the pilgrims. When you look at the early relationships, as soon as March 1621, remember that was just a few months after the winter as the spring began to dawn, a sagamore or a chief from the Pemaquid named Somerset, which is now near Bristol, Maine, walked right in. This must have been a startling event, but he walked right into a meeting of the pilgrims with their guns, have a military meeting, sort of a strategy meeting to figure out how to protect themselves. And in walks this chief in his full dress, walks right into the middle of this meeting, and it ends up being a peaceful meeting. So he sort of boldly announces himself, and the pilgrims realized that he didn't mean them harm, but really wanted to make friends with them because he could see that they intended to stay. And so really, the Wampanoags, through the offices of Squanto or Tisquantum, ended up having a very peaceful relationship for all of this period from 1620 to 1675. It doesn't mean it wasn't strained at times, but in God's providence and through the gentleness and the sense of justice that the pilgrims had, and as well the Indians had, they managed to get along quite well. And that ended up enabling them to really begin to settle in. In fact, Squanto engineered a meeting between Somerset and Edward Winslow and then Governor Carver, which issued in the first treaty. And so, oddly enough, as they entered into a peace treaty with the Wampanoag, it ended up that Massasoit had entered into a treaty with the King of England, with King James and the Stuart monarchy. As an amazing way that happened. And, of course, Massasoit had no idea the kind of powerful arrangement that he had entered into. Already in the summer of 1621, the pilgrims ended up coming to the aid of Massasoit against the Narragansetts, and then the biggest test came in a situation which I don't have time to enumerate, where it ended up that the alliance was saved, but also because it appeared to the Massasoit that Squanto had betrayed them, they ended up saving Squanto, even though he died shortly after that, and in God's providence, the alliance and the peace was kept. The greatest trouble that came, and it's interesting, if you look at other missionary stories, you'll see the same thing happens over and over, that it was the traders that came from other places, and they came and mistreated and cheated the Indians. But it was not the pilgrims or the Puritans subsequently that ever engaged in that kind of activity. In fact, Massasoit, over time, over these early years, was deeply impressed with the integrity of these pilgrims. That's, of course, a tremendously important missionary attribute that the people that we go to spread the gospel among should be able to trust that we are trustworthy. They should see faithfulness in our lives. And so one writer, Alden Vaughan, says this. He says, "The familiar charge that Europeans brought chaos to peaceful Indian tribes does not apply to the early years of New Plymouth. Evidence of Plymouth's just treatment of the Indians is, to be sure, primarily from pilgrim accounts, but corroboration is offered by such diverse commentators as John Pory of Virginia, Increase Mather of Massachusetts, and Isaac de Rossier of New Netherlands. On a visit to Plymouth in 1628, Rossier was impressed by the natives' high regard for the English, and he concluded that the Indians better conducted themselves because of the fine example of law and living set by the Pilgrim colony." But then there was Thomas Morton. And in the middle of the 1620s, this dubious character who claimed to be a lawyer came and settled a village that was sort of inland from Boston Bay and ended up having wild parties, seducing Indian women, getting the Indians drunk, and then selling them firearms. So really a threat to the civil order of this small population. And so, and again, this is often misinterpreted, but wisely, Miles Standish gathered an army from the pilgrims, went in, arrested Morton, and sent him and the colonists back to England where they belonged. He ends up coming back again later on. But oftentimes what you see is that these were the English who were such prudes, that these pilgrims, that they didn't want to party, they didn't want to have fun. And that's such a silly way of interpreting this event, because they were, as Vaughan actually says in his account, that if it had just been some rabble-rousing around a fire in a village, there wouldn't have been a problem necessarily. But it was when they started getting them drunk and seducing their women and selling them firearms, that was a threat to the civil order. And they properly understood that this could not be tolerated. And so it wasn't. And I'm sure the Indians watched this kind of thing and they saw, these are people that can be trusted to keep good order. These are people that we are going to be wise to be allied with. Now, things did not remain the same very long. And even though there were, I think there were 7 other settlements besides Plymouth that sort of surrounded themselves around Boston Bay, so sort of around the present burbs, maybe a swath roughly like 128, there were a number of these settlements, Salem being the northernmost. And as these were there, there were places there for people to come and to migrate from England. And that's precisely what they did. And there was a huge migration beginning in about 1628 and then especially in 1630. And so the Puritans came to form the Massachusetts Bay Colony, Governor John Winthrop arriving in 1630 on the ship the Arabella. And subsequent to that, 17 ships brought more than 1,000 colonists to the Mass Bay Colony. By 1632, there were 2,000 residents. By 1637, 8,000. And the total population had swelled in that short time to something over 21,000 settlers. And so when Winthrop arrived, remember, this is just 10 years later after the pilgrims arrived as people almost not surviving. When Winthrop arrives, a number of the local chiefs come to greet him because already they have great respect for the English system of law as well as the power that they have to mobilize against attack. And so we have then the Bay Colony, Massachusetts Bay Colony. That's the one we're all familiar with, settled by Puritans. And remember, the difference is that the pilgrims, they weren't Puritans, the pilgrims were separatists. They believed that the Church of England had gone off the track and they wanted to start a separated church, their own church, their own community. Whereas the Puritans believed that they were continuing the reformation of the Church of England, of which they considered themselves still a part. And yet they felt that they could have more liberty to continue that reformation in a place where the Church of England didn't have much direct control over their doings. And that's an important distinction that plays out in the history of early New England. And Captain John Endicott, you may recognize these names, all kinds of places and other things are named after these early settlers. But he came with the New England Company, and he was instructed under the new Mass Bay Charter to continue the policy of tolerance that the Pilgrims had established and to endeavor to bring the Indians to a knowledge of the gospel. Were there monetary gains in view? Yes. Was there a kind of religious freedom? Not the kind of pluralism that we have today, but was there religious freedom envisioned? Yes, certainly. But there was also a desire to spread the gospel to the natives. Remember, they'd seen them in England. They knew that they didn't have the knowledge of God, and they wanted them to have that knowledge. We should never let historians rob us of that heritage that the Pilgrims and the Puritans very clearly had back in these early days. Now, notice also that the settlers who sought to harm the Indians were actually punished now. We begin to see English law, and especially the biblical idea of equity and fairness, was brought into the colonies, and the Indians began to experience this. And so our old friend Thomas Morton shows up again in 1629, and he is punished. And he's punished by having his house burned in the audience of the Indians in order to show that the Puritans understood fairness of law and that they weren't going to favor the English or the Europeans over against the Indians. It was a remarkable event, and I guess at that point Thomas Morton was permanently humbled. One of the main reasons, Vaughan says, for the good relationship between the natives of the Bay Colony and the natives and the Bay Colony was the determination of the Puritan authorities to prevent their subjects from maltreating the natives. In fact, during a smallpox epidemic that also killed many more thousands of Indians during the 1630s, the colonists were very gracious, not only in nursing the sick, but in adopting orphans that were left behind into the Puritan families. And so they showed exemplary love for the native people. Also, there were gun and liquor laws. And a lot of times, again, this is portrayed as being mean and cruel, keeping guns and liquor from these Indians. But they did have a propensity to get drunk very easily. And awful things happened when this happened. This fire water was a whole new thing to them. They couldn't handle it. And so out of love for them and out of care for the civil order, as well as their possession of guns, the Puritans were very careful to restrict the sale of both of these items in order to protect the Indians. Also, there is the great myth, and Vaughan, in his book, spends a particular amount of time in dispelling this myth that the Puritans robbed the Indians of their lands. And there were two theories that he says are invalid. One is that the lands were simply sold for nothing, for little trinkets. It's simply not true as you look at the evidence. And then secondly, that the Indians didn't understand land ownership or the idea of transferring with deeds. Their deeds weren't written, but they were word of mouth. And remember, in an oral culture, you remember what people say, and it's said in public, and it's remembered by everyone, and it's passed on from generation to generation. The disparity between the English and Indian concepts of land tenure was actually rather slight, says Vaughan. One of the early Puritans, Edward Winslow, reported that every sachem, that would be the chiefs of the tribes, knoweth how far his bounds and limits of his own country extendeth, And that is his own proper inheritance. While they may not have measured it as a surveyor would, they could tell you that from such and such a point to such and such a point, that was where their land began and someone else's, or their land ended and someone else's began. And so that is really a myth. Now, it is true, remember, that the Puritans brought a view of English law with them as well as biblical law, that they did understand that the patents that were granted by the king, the royal patents, gave them possession of all of the lands of New England. But what's interesting is that they never allowed this as a reason to simply take land from the Indians. And in fact, they believed that wherever there were claims that the Indians have, or if they were in actual possession of the land, that they would never go and take those lands, and that if they were to enter into an agreement and buy the lands for a fair price, there would be a deed recording the transaction in detail, and that often the Indians retained full hunting, fishing, and sometimes even planting rights. So again, it's not to say that every Puritan treated every Indian transaction fairly, but the record shows that the Puritans were meticulous because they understood that this was part of their witness as Christians and their desire to build a Christian commonwealth, that this was extremely important, that they were ultimately accountable, of course, not to men, not to the King of England even, but to God himself. Now, something very powerful happened in 1637 that really changed everything. Up to this point, there was a real question as to whether the Indians might at some point gather together and say, we want you back in England. This endeavor is over. And they had power, although the population shift began to make that less and less a possibility. But in a very complex situation, the Pequot tribe, which had been actually invaders of New England some century before the Puritans came, were a militant tribe, southwestern New England. And they were constantly in conflict with the Wampanoags, with the Nipmucks, with others, the Massachusetts Indians. And they were militant. And we can't fully figure out the reasons why. But there were a number of people that were brutally killed, Captain Stone, John Oldham. They were simply traders, and they were coming with cargo, and they were brutally murdered. And when the Puritans sought to deal with the Pequots, to bring some kind of justice to the situation, the Pequots started rattling their swords, and they didn't really want anything to do with it. Now, the problem is, of course, that Endicott goes, brings an army, gathers it from the other colonies, and enters in and completely wipes out at the Mystic Port. He wipes out all of the Pequots so that within a generation, there were almost none of them left. Many of the tribes of New England were very happy, actually, that they were gone because they had caused much trouble. And yet there were many Puritans who raised questions about the justice of the way in which this was done, though it seemed that that some military force did need to be exercised. But again, you see this tremendous consciousness. Even in this disagreement, they sought justice. And we know how difficult justice is, even in a local church or in a family. And so here was a whole colony or several colonies seeking to be just to the local inhabitants. And so what happened then was that during the war, Mass Bay, Plymouth, and Connecticut, which were the three basic colonies, they really came together. And this confederation really meant that the possibility of the Indians ever gathering together against them was very, very slim. There was an intercolonial league that was started so that a number of the colonies, now New Haven, was also added to this, gathered together. And many of the Indians, as Vaughan says, were very happy that they had done this because they were providing justice that they weren't able to provide for themselves. And so a period of peace up until King Philip's War began to take place. When we look at the legal structure of the colonies, we see that the Puritans brought a structure of law that the Indians just had no knowledge of. They had a system of equity and a way of actually administering this in a court system that the Indians were basically in awe of. And many times the Indians would actually go to the Puritans and say, "We can't figure this case out. Will you help us with this?" And they would. And so in the English justice system, and especially with a strong biblical input, ended up being a tremendous benefit to everyone in early New England. Now, the Mass Bay Colony, though, did assume that the royal patents not only meant that they owned all of New England in terms of land, but that all of the Indians were under their jurisdiction. What we notice, however, is that the Plymouth Colony, just as an example, basically left the Nauset and the Wampanoag alone unless someone committed a crime or there were groups of Indians that sought to threaten the settlers. And so even though they wanted to impose that system, but they really wanted to do it in a way that would be beneficial for all. And so they basically left the Indians alone unless their activities called for some type of action on their part. And so, while they weren't perfect, they indeed sought justice, and the rule of law was one that was very important to them. Now, it's in that context, I'm just trying to paint a picture, there's so much more that could be said, that the early missionary endeavors, which is really the point of the lecture this evening, began to take effect. And there's so much more that could be said about this effort and particularly about John Eliot. But let me just give you a brief sketch of the ways in which they sought to spread the gospel. First of all, that when they first came, you need to remember that even though they wanted to see these Native or Indian Americans become Christians, that they were in survival mode so for so much of the time during that first decade or two. And even as they sought to figure out the politics of the different tribes and to establish their own interrelationships among the colonists, this was what occupied much of their energy, their time, as well as their money. And so there was a slow progress in spreading the gospel. It's not a missions effort that you'd look at and say, wow, you know, they landed and they were out there preaching the gospel. No, they landed and they were trying to figure out, how will I survive this cold night and how will I find enough food to live until tomorrow? The second thing is that the Indians were a completely, one could not imagine a more completely foreign culture. They didn't understand the language, their mode of dress and their way of living, the houses they lived in. It was all utterly foreign to these Puritans and pilgrims. And so they didn't have a clue. They had to learn all of this stuff. And we see that it was only in 1643, 23 years later, that Roger Williams published a very simple key to the language of America, which was a help ultimately to missions efforts. Also, and here's something to really remember when it comes to planting Reformed churches. The Puritans were not into easy believism. The Roman Catholic missions were accused of that by the Puritans, and I think in most cases quite justly, that they were happy for nominal conversions. People who would say, yes, I am a Catholic, and now let's eat dinner together or something like that. But in fact, the Puritans were maybe even the opposite extreme, is that they had to teach the truth to the convert, and they had to see evidence of the truth being believed in their lives. This was no easy business, and the Puritans never thought that being a Christian was a simple or easy business. And so they didn't underestimate what needed to be done in order to change a people that had no knowledge of the Bible, the English language, or the ways of Christians. They didn't believe that this would be an easy thing, and indeed it wasn't. Now, there were in this early time, however, conversions in a very informal way. A sachem named John Sagamore of Watertown, that sounds funny, I once lived there when I was in school, but changed quite a bit since then, but he was the chief of that place, and he professed faith. And he ended up keeping it private because the scorn of the tribe that he was the chief of inhibited him saying, "I am a Christian." But on his deathbed, he actually gave his son over to a minister, John Wilson, and said, "Raise my child in the Christian faith." And so his faith was a real faith. It was genuine. He wasn't going to leave his son to his own people because he had believed the gospel. And so all of this early period was summarized by Edward Winslow in a work that he published in 1649, right at the end of that early period, called The Glorious Progress of the Gospel Among the Indians of New England. Thomas Mayhew is another interesting character, and the final one that we'll mention during this early period, and this extends into the second, more fruitful period. But Thomas Mayhew, and we were just on Martha's Vineyard, incidentally, and there are Mayhews still on Martha's Vineyard. They're still there. It's a prominent name in that small island. And he went there in 1641, he arrived with his dad, but they bought the island in 1641 and began to evangelize. And Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard, as well as several other small islands, were evangelized. And by 1650, there were 22 converts. Now, according to home mission standards in many denominations, that would be a pretty lousy take. But according to Puritan standards, it was wonderful, because in order to claim 22 converts, Mayhew had to know that these were serious Christians. They'd really come to understand the gospel, and their lives gave evidence of this. And he and John Eliot ended up being the two of the greatest evangelists of early New England history. And John Eliot is called the Apostle to the Indians. I would recommend Ola Elizabeth Winslow. She's obviously related to Puritans herself, though I don't know that she was an Orthodox Christian. But she wrote a wonderful biography in the 20th century about John Eliot, calling it the Apostle to the Indians. But that's what he was known as in his own day. He led a very fruitful life. He was born in Whitford in Essex County, England, in 1604, just after the death of Queen Elizabeth. And then he went to Jesus College, Cambridge, and it's there that he learned the Reformed faith, and perhaps it's there that he became an actual Christian. He arrived in Boston in November of 1631, just a decade later, from the Mayflower in a ship called the Lion. He ends up substituting for John Wilson, who was visiting in England. And he took his congregation for 1 year in Boston. And then when Wilson comes back, he refuses to be the associate pastor, and he goes to Roxbury and takes a church there. And he is the minister in that place for 58 years until he dies and goes to be with the Lord in 1690. He became, over a lifetime, the single, not there was no one even comparing to him, most beloved man. There was no one like him, because he showed kindness to everyone. He was stubborn in his desire to see the gospel spread to everyone he came in contact with. And he never gave up. He never quit. Even if there were two or three in a village that he'd worked in for years, he kept going. He kept moving forward. He kept preaching the gospel and believing that God had called him to preach and that God would take care of the fruit. That wasn't up to him. His was to be a faithful minister. And he was. He did amazing things during the period that he spread the gospel until his death at the end of the 17th century. Now, what's interesting is that the way that the Lord orchestrated him learning the Algonquin language is that there was a man, an Indian from Long Island, named Cochino. And Cochino was a very bright young man. And he was a servant of someone who lived in Dorchester, near Roxbury. And he wanted to learn to read and to speak English. And so John Eliot taught him to read and speak English, and he in turn learned Algonquin. And so he began to work on a way of writing Algonquin so that he could eventually begin to write things in Algonquin to convert the Indians, and ultimately, of course, as you know, to translate the Bible. And so his first efforts began in 1646, as he had come to some fluency. He discounted his fluency, but he was fluent enough to preach a 75-minute sermon, the first sermon to the Indians there in Nonantum, which is now Newton, Massachusetts. Can you imagine? There was John Eliot there in a wilderness situation in Newton, Massachusetts, and he was invited by a friendly chief named Waban. And he came into his wigwam, he presented the gospel, and so impressed was Waban that he said, "Take my son and teach him the gospel and the English ways." And so he ended up being enrolled in a school in Dedham. And so the first service in Algonquin was conducted here in that village that Waban was the chief of on October 28th, just about Reformation Day. And that was in 1646. There's actually a detailed account of this was later printed by the other four Puritan ministers that were present, and it was used to raise funds in England. But imagine, he preached for 75 minutes in Algonquin. This man knew it better than he had admitted in his humility, and he preached the gospel to them. There was a description of exactly what he presented to them. He gave them the law. He told them the holy requirements of the Ten Commandments in detail. And then he preached the gospel of forgiveness to them. And many of them were deeply, deeply impressed with this. Afterwards, he had a Q&A. I got a kick out of this. It was such an informal thing. He preached and then said, "What do you have for questions?" And they kept him for a number of hours asking him very intelligent questions about what they had heard. Then the other ministers that had come with him distributed apples to the children and tobacco to the men. I thought that was pretty interesting. They had no scruples about smoking back in those days. And they wanted to impress the Indians with the fact that they really did care for them and wanted to leave these gifts with them. 2 weeks later, many gathered now in this village. They were fascinated by what this man, Eliot, had to say. And thus began a lifelong weekly preaching to the Indians by John Eliot. On alternate Thursdays, he began to preach in Dorchester, which was then called Neponset, as actually is a place in Massachusetts called Neponset. And many began to be won over to the gospel. The sachem of what now is Concord, Massachusetts, asked Eliot to come, and by 1647, many had become Christians and wanted to learn the English way of living. Now, this is an interesting thing. We should stand back for a moment and add a little footnote that it's often thought that we were, you know, the imperialist. That's a nasty label to put on someone. And there is such a thing as imperialism, which we would reject. But they weren't imperialists. They believed that English culture reflected what it meant to be serious about living the Christian life. Now, we could go back and say, well, wait a minute, there are certain things about the way you dress or whatever that are unique to a culture and they're not particularly Christian one way or another. But I think that what's underestimated in our evaluation of what they did is that for the Puritans, to believe the gospel meant a complete transformation of one's life, the way that one lived from day to day. And that meant, in their case, learning to be productive, to take up different trades, to learn various ways, which were simply part of the English culture that they were part of. And so it wasn't that they disrespected the Indians, though maybe there were areas that they missed some good things. But the fact was that Christian faith and life were never separated for these Puritans. Now, the Synod of Cambridge in 1647 was a kind of turning point. You know, that's when the Cambridge Platform was formulated. And old John Eliot understood advertising, even in its most primitive form. And the best way was to bring some of these best converts to that synod and show the Puritans there in Boston or in Cambridge what was going on, what was happening in the mission work. And this garnered lots of support. There was more skepticism in England, but ultimately Eliot's persistence, his prayer, his preaching ended up really winning the day. Now, it's sort of an interesting little aside is that the Penacook sachem, who would have been just north of where we are right now, Passaconaway, I just climbed his mountain the other day. It's a lovely 4,000-footer there in the Whites. And he, when he first heard Eliot preach, went and hid in the woods. But the people didn't follow him. They were interested in Eliot. And many of them became Christians. And ultimately, though Passaconaway himself never gave direct evidence of a Christian profession, he saw how good the work of Eliot was, and he supported him. So he completely turned around in his attitude. Interestingly, on the way up Passaconaway, I crossed a river. That's always a little daunting when you're hiking, but we had to cross a sort of rushing river, odd at this time of year, but really rushing. And it's a real river. It's maybe 30 or 40 feet wide. And guess what the name is? It's Wanalancet. And do you know who Wanalancet was? It was Passaconaway's son. And he became a true Christian. And so it was so interesting to see that the names of places here in New Hampshire really remind us of that missionary history in New Hampshire and in New England. Well, there was much that was written by this among a number of clergymen here in New England. They wrote, they wanted to convince even the Parliament in England that this was a worthy endeavor. And indeed, money began to flow. And in the years from 1650 to 1665, the greatest fruitfulness came into being. 1651, the first praying town, Natick, Massachusetts. It was the first town that was actually set up by Eliot. Now, we wouldn't completely agree with this, but he understood that the Indians needed to own their own culture. They needed to learn just ways of dealing with one another. And so he gave them the authority, and they ended up becoming a praying town. And eventually, it took a long time, and I think Eliot was a bit frustrated by the length that it took to do this. But by 1660, they actually were approved by the powers that be to become a covenanting church in New England. And so it took from 1620 to 1660 before the first covenanting Indian, bona fide Indian Reformed Church actually came into being. But it did, and it did because several men were, and I'm sure that their wives and others in their churches were praying behind them, were persistent in spreading the gospel. There's so much else that could be said here, but let me just briefly mention that at the end, right before King Philip's War, which changed everything in one way for the better, but in many other ways for the worse in terms of Indian relations and missions among the Indians, but at that time there were 14 praying towns, and something like 20% of the Indian population had become Christians. Actually, it's amazing that almost everyone on Martha's Vineyard under Mayhew's ministry confessed to be a Christian. And every single sachem was a true Christian, was someone that really took the Christian faith seriously. Maybe some of the members of the tribe were simply nominal because their leader had made this confession. But the whole place was a place that had sort of like Geneva of old, a savor of the Christian gospel and faith. The crowning achievement, of course, of Eliot, which he's remembered by everyone for, is that by 1663 and beginning in 1654, he had translated the entire Bible. Imagine doing that. No computers, no electric lights, no ballpoint pens, no typewriters even. He just had his quill, oil light. He worked tireless hours, and he finally translated everything, the entire Bible, into the Algonquin language. That was really the crowning achievement, and we could go on, and will, by simply saying in conclusion that New England missions has continued to this day. We're praying Indians here at Amiskeag Presbyterian Church, and in a real sense continue the heritage of John Eliot and those original Puritans, though we don't have any actual direct relationship by blood to the Indians of early New England. In fact, the Society for the Propagation of the Reformed Faith, and if you just substitute the word gospel, that's exactly what the original Puritans called their organization, which the Parliament had approved. But here, John Murray and a number of men with him started this society, and it actually still in principle exists today because the OPC, as well as other Reformed churches, are here in New England seeking to have a witness to the people of this place. And there are many lessons here, which I hope you've picked up along the way. But in closing, let me just mention a few. As we think about the native New Englanders of that era, ours are as needy as they were. They knew nothing of the gospel or of the English language. Now, presumably, our fellow citizens here in New England do know the English language, but they know nothing, almost nothing, of the gospel. In fact, I would say there are two basic categories of people in New England today. There are those who know only a part of what the Bible teaches, but not the gospel itself. They know what's old Unitarianism. They know morality. They maybe know some of the Ten Commandments and believe that that's what Christianity is, and therefore it's an oppressive system that simply says you can't have fun and we're going to oppress you so you don't have freedom and liberty to do what you please. That's not the gospel. They don't know the good news. They only know the bad news. Indeed, the law does condemn us all to death, but the gospel gives life, forgiveness, and a new creation. The second kind of person is those who are completely illiterate about the Christian faith. They know nothing about it except perhaps some slanderous remarks made on the evening news about those mean-spirited folks that call themselves Christians, the fundamentalists. And so they know nothing. And so, again, they need to hear the good news. And I would venture to say that one of the great things we can get from the early Puritans and pilgrims is not only their zeal to preach the gospel, the word of God, but the kindness with which they sought to make that gospel sink in, that they sought to be kind to their neighbor. They sought, whether they became Christians or not, was irrelevant. That's what they prayed for, but they treated them fairly and justly and kindly anyway, because that's what God called them to do. And that's what God really calls us to do. That's what he has gathered his people to do as witnesses, as pilgrims in this world. And I believe, as a final principle, that, and this was sort of implicit in the Puritan understanding, that they simply sought to build churches where the ordinary means of grace were faithfully administered. The preaching of the word, the sacraments of the Lord's Supper and baptism and prayer. So the visible church was a witness to the grace of God. And they didn't try to do anything fancier than that, nor anything less than that. Because I would actually say that when we try to do something fancier, we won't do that. And so we will miss the very thing that God is seeking to have us establish. Vaughan ends his book by saying this. He said that the example of those New England Puritans was that they treated the Indians not as a race apart, but as fellow sinners in God's great universe. And we could add to that who were in need of God's grace. And that's all I have to say about Puritans and Indians in New England and their missionary effort.